Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. One that's living over there right now, just dropped on the day that we're recording this, so I know it's available the day you're listening to it, Outlaw God. Not the trailer, the first episode. First episode, kind of an introduction to what that podcast is going to be about. Outlaw God with Stephen Paulson. Search it up on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And subscribe to that, man. Give old Dr. Paulson a listen and see what you like. Eric, you and I were talking earlier. We've both already listened to it. It dropped today. We've both checked it out already.
Yeah, I actually subscribed to the podcast today. I thought I had already subscribed. And in my rush to look for the episode today, I couldn't find it. And so I pushed on the little button, listened to the episode. It was great. Really, really good information. And looking forward to the rest of the series, man.
Yeah. Yeah, good time. So go do that. Other than that, Eric, how's it going, man?
You know, still, I feel like we're inching back to something resembling normal here. We just actually got the governor's order today that churches can reopen with certain strict guidelines. And so we're weighing all that out and trying to figure out what that looks like. And, you know, probably doing the things that a lot of other people have already begun doing in the rest of the country. We're just starting to get there. So looking forward to, goodness gracious, like, something resembling normal in 2020.
Yeah,
too much abnormal in 2020, man.
Well, the election should sort it all out, I'm sure. That's when things will start to really feel normal. I'm guessing things will feel really normal around October, November. Things will be normal as can be.
Well, if prior election years are any indication, I'm sure you're right, Dan. It's always a peace-loving and fun time.
If this is how it's going to be every election year from now on, I'm just going to take every 4 years off.
I think it's a good idea.
Just take it
off. It's a good idea. Just move to the mountain somewhere and hide.
Yeah, hunker down, come back out when it's over. Well, we're here in Luke chapter 22, towards the end of it. So we'll finish up this chapter, get into chapter 23 as well today. Left off with Peter denying Christ three times and going out and weeping bitterly.
Indeed. And now we're still, I mean, as that happened, that was when Jesus was sort of being put through a mock trial before the various Jewish leaders before the Sanhedrin. And so we pick it up at verse 63. It says, "Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, 'Prophesy, who is it that struck you?' And they said many other things against him, blaspheming him." Now, it's just one thing to note here, Dan, before we move on. Jesus absolutely knew who it was that struck him.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Jesus absolutely could have prophesied, as they described it here, and declared that news to them. But of course, Jesus doesn't, because he is even now actively fulfilling prophecy, right? What does Isaiah say? He goes to his death like a lamb before its shears is silent.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is not going to defend himself. He's not trying to avoid the inevitable fate that's coming his way. He is accepting it and going through with it. And that's one of the indicators that we see in a passage like this.
Yeah, this is all part of the sort of fulfillment of the humiliation of Christ.
That's right. That's right. And so it says, "When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council. And they said, 'If you are the Christ, tell us.' But he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God.' So they all said, 'Are you the Son of God then?' And he said to them, 'You say that I am.' Then they said, 'What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips.'" Now, this is interesting, Dan. I mean, because he doesn't seem to come sort of right out and say it just bluntly, but he is referencing language that they would recognize as being clearly messianic.
Yeah. Yeah. So they ask, if you're the Christ, and he says, "If I tell you, you won't believe me. Why are you asking questions to which you already have your mind made up of the answer?"
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to answer that. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. That's a pretty
clear indicator. Yeah,
it's a big yes.
I mean, that's referencing the prophet Daniel. That's very clear imagery. The right hand of God is clear imagery of the messianic location. all of that stuff is stuff that people that are versed well in the Old Testament scriptures would have recognized.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then they say, you just said it. Are you saying that you are the Son of God then? And he says, you say that I am.
Yeah, that's it. He's not fighting it. He's not going to, again, he's not going to make a defense. He's going to state who he is and let them do what they're going to do.
He's also, by saying this, it's interesting. He says that you say that I am. There is something, there has got to be something in the scribes, the chief priests, that know that they're not dealing with just like some guy.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is not faith. They're not believe the promises of God. They don't believe the things that he is saying. But what he is doing is sort of outing them. I mean, because before, I mean, other times they'll come to him and say, no one can do the things that you do unless God is with him and this sort of stuff. They're just entrenched in unbelief. But they know, you have to know intellectually that you're dealing with something different. And it seems to me that what Jesus is doing partially in this is telling them that they hate God.
Yeah, that's right.
When he says, like, you say that I am, it's not just that he's saying you said those words in that question, but it's sort of this, that you know it, but you don't believe it. And this is an interesting distinction, right? Because we would like faith to be knowing, mm-hmm. right? So we think that faith is certainty and faith is knowing. Well, faith and knowing are not the same thing. In fact, it's a good thing that they're not the same thing, because I would argue that the Pharisees and the scribes and the chief priests, they know something's going on here, but they do not believe.
Yeah. It reminds me of the distinctions that were made during the Reformation about different kinds of faith. And it's possible to know all the elements of the Christian faith and yet not have faith. And why is that? Because saving faith says Jesus Christ came, lived, died, and rose again for me. And it's possible. And even we know people that believe he lived and that he died and that he even rose again that do not believe it was for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be very much the situation going on here, although they will deny. It's funny, they, you know, when Jesus does eventually rise, they don't even try to deny that it happened. They just try and cover it up.
Right. That's what I mean. I mean, like,
again,
if you think that, like, oh, if I could just see it with my own eyes, that would be the solution. It's not the solution. These guys saw all kinds of things with their own eyes. They know more than we could ever know.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they do not believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, the Jewish leadership being convinced that Jesus has outed himself and that he is clearly blaspheming, claiming to be the Messiah, now have to go and work with the government officials, something that the leadership does not like doing.
Yeah.
They're not fans of Pontius Pilate. They're not fans of the Roman occupiers, but they know that they don't have any authority to do much more to Jesus, and so they've got to play nice with Pilate.
Yeah, and they're going to have to play some games here too, because contrary to what you may have heard, Rome doesn't really have an issue with Jesus at this point that we see. They're very disinterested.
Like, yeah, I think if anything, they're just apathetic about mm-hmm. the whole thing. They just don't want the trouble that seems to be coming from the citizenry of Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's the religious leaders that have a problem with Jesus, yeah. not really the Roman occupiers. Roman occupiers, all they want at this point in their rule over the Jews is just for them to just not cause problems. That's all they want.
That's really the motivation here. That's right. And so we move into chapter 23. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Now that is clearly them trying to make Jesus out to be an insurrectionist.
Right.
Jesus, they're trying to bring up, even though their charges against him really don't have anything to do with the things they mention here, they know that this will at least get the attention of a Roman governor. So they say he forbid us to give tribute to Caesar, which, by the way, not true.
Right.
Like, he actually endorses it. And that he himself is Christ, which Pilate wouldn't care about. Like, okay, you've got a guy who's claiming to be Messiah. Like, we've seen this before. But a king. He's claiming to be a king. And that's what gets Pilate's attention.
Yeah, so I mean, and what you're going to see is Pilate's only going to ask him sort of one question.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus gives him an answer, and he finds this sort of whole thing cooked up.
Yeah, you can tell that he's skeptical. And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." Now, in other words, what this is saying is he's a rabble rouser. He's going to make your life hard, Pilate. He's going, if you allow him to go, he might just foment some sort of revolt against your rule. You gotta take him into custody. You gotta deal with this man.
Yeah. But they let something sort of out of the bag here when they said this. When they said, "Stirs up trouble all through Judea from Galilee even to this place," and Pilate all of a sudden hears something in there because, again, he thinks that this whole thing is a little cooked up, Pilate does not trust the chief priests and scribes. Mm-hmm. But when they said that word Galilee, he says, "Wait a minute, is this dude a Galilean?" And this is he's going to try to use this key, this detail, to get himself off the hook from having to deal with these guys that it kind of seems that Pilate just doesn't want to deal with. These guys are probably a real thorn in his side.
Yeah, Pilate's a politician, man, and he's happy to sort of push off the problem to somewhere else if he can. And so, you know, verse 6, when Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. So, I mean, it's important to note, like, you know, the government, you had Pilate as the governor, but you also had these various sort of districts, you know, much like we have today, in which somebody was responsible for law and order in that particular area. And Herod's responsible for what happens in Galilee. And so Pilate says, "Well, bring him to him first. I don't want to have to deal with him then."
Mm-hmm.
And so verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him.
This is not what the scribes and chief priests are going for here. This is not the sort of thing that they want going on. Like, go send him to Herod. They're like, "All right, fine, we'll send him to Herod." And Herod's like, "Oh, goody."
Yeah, Herod's like, "Oh man, you know, a miracle worker, a magician."
But so I was hoping I get to meet this guy. Like, it's just, this is so far not going. And then what you can see in the way this shakes out with the back and forth here is that, man, there's really no charges here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what you're really getting, is that, like, nobody, the objective outside party doesn't see it.
Yeah. So he questioned him at length, verse 9, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. So apparently, you know, Herod being like, you know, whatever, I'm not going to deal with it. Go ahead and go back to Pilate. For whatever reason, that created some sense of camaraderie between the two. Verse 13, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him."
Yeah, so Pilate's going to try to make a little concession here. So Herod and Pilate kind of bond over the fact that these scribes and chief priests are, you know, a pain in the butt, and they don't like dealing with them. Nothing unites like a common annoyance. And so Pilate's like, "All right, look, here's what we'll do. Like, just give this guy a beating, let him go. that surely that's enough. Because in Pilate's mind, he hasn't really done anything.
Yeah, yeah. He's just troubled a bunch of the people that are troubling him. And this is really annoying to him. And so, again, you're seeing the sort of indifference, which is not okay. It's not excusable what Rome's indifference is here.
No.
But it's just to clarify that really it's the religious leaders that are intent on doing away with him right now, whereas the Roman they're just indifferent. They're ambivalent about it. They don't care. They just want the nuisance to go away.
Yeah, I mean, without the constant nagging and pushing of the religious leaders, I mean, Jesus walks out of this thing. I mean, Pilate would have done nothing initially.
Yeah. But they all cried out together, verse 18, "Away with this man and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder." Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." A third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So really what's happening is Pilate is seeing the elevation of sort of a mob mentality against his rule.
Yes.
Like he's seeing a large gathering of people saying, they're shouting over and over again, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate knows that whatever peace he holds in that city is very tenuous. And yep. that it could go in an instant if he doesn't at least somehow give into some things that the populace wants.
Yeah, at this point, you do see that keeping the peace is more important to Pilate than justice or doing the right thing. He would prefer not to condemn someone he views as innocent to death, but if that's what it takes to keep the peace, he's willing to do it. So yeah. there's not like Pilate is exuding tons of righteousness or anything.
Pilate's not a man of integrity.
No, he's a pragmatist. He's a pragmatist who would prefer to not falsely execute people, but you know, if you gotta, you gotta.
Yeah, push comes to shove. So their voices prevailed. Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will.
Now, this whole thing is fascinating with Barabbas. First of all, with Pilate. Pilate is a sort of unfortunate character who makes it into the creed. He's the only guy that makes it into the creed. You have the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, Mary, and Pilate. Yeah. And you want to talk about a guy that's been remembered for since this day.
In a very infamous way,
yes. So this is the man who makes it into the creed. And I, whenever I'm saying the creed, I always think about that. Like, man, I bet you were not thinking that was what was going to happen. You would be remembered for all time for this. I mean, this is probably in Pilate's mind a pretty throwaway act.
Because it was something that Rome did all the time.
Yeah.
It was something that, I mean, we're told in other gospels that it was a tradition to release a prisoner that the crowd wanted for another. In this case, it is interesting also the prisoner that they decide to release. First of all, a man who's guilty of insurrection against the Roman state and murder, Barabbas, which by the way means son of the father, is exchanged for the completely innocent, true son of the father. And Jesus, in this sense, you can see this exchange taking place where the guilty man is allowed to go free and where the innocent man is condemned for the crimes of the guilty man.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is exactly what you have. You have the actual playing out of the great exchange. Jesus, the innocent, will go to the cross, and Barabbas, the guilty, will go free.
That's right. So verse 26, "And as they led him away, they seized one Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and laid on him the cross to carry it behind Jesus." Now, just a couple of historical notes here, Dan, that I think are important for context. One, the cross was probably not fully assembled when it was put on the back of Simon of Cyrene to carry. Sometimes you kind of get that impression, especially if you see old art, you know, old stained glass windows, you know, that the cross is fully assembled and they're kind of dragging it on their back. Probably, though, it was just the cross beam and the taller beam that it's connected to was not connected to it yet. They probably didn't do that until they got to the site of the crucifixion.
They reused the vertical part.
That's right.
Over and over and over. Actually, they reused all of it, but they would just keep those basically up. You know, they're on top of the places that they did this crucifixion. This wasn't a unique place to do a crucifixion.
Yeah.
They'd done them there before, and so there's things to crucify.
Yeah, there's a reason it was called the place of the skull.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And the second thing is that Simon of Cyrene, you know, you can sort of look at it and go, oh, that's interesting, you know, that Luke decides to let us know that some guy named Simon of Cyrene is the guy who carried the cross for Jesus. But it actually matters, because that probably shows that Luke knows his audience knows who Simon of Cyrene is. So there's almost a little apologetic, you know, footnote here that you might not notice up front, that like, this is Luke saying, hey, you know Simon. Mark does the same thing by mentioning Simon's sons. And, you know, Richard Bauckham, who's got a great book on the resurrection of Jesus and sort of the evidence for the historicity of Jesus, uses this as one of his evidences for why the Gospels are historically reliable, because there's mentioning of names that don't really add anything to the story except for the fact that probably the early church knew who they were talking about. And so just a little footnote there. Verse 27, and there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? Now, that's an allusion to the destruction of the temple that will happen in just a little over three decades from this moment. And Jesus is basically, when he says, if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? Well, the implication is that right now, at least, there's still some evidence of life, but things are going to get to a point where it's going to be completely barren and they're really going to go crazy. And indeed that happens, both with Rome taking over the city, tearing down the temple. You can read the histories from Josephus and others from that time period. The way they describe the destruction of the temple is horrific. And the death in Jerusalem is horrific. And so Jesus isn't saying this necessarily. I mean, I don't think he's saying this as a threat. I think he's saying this as like, it's going to get even worse. Like, this is just the beginning of what things will look like here. And so two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him, verse 32. And when they came to the place that is called the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, it's just an important statement, I think, for us to emphasize, because it's one of these things that doesn't come through in English as well. But in the original language that the scriptures were written, you could accurately translate it. It would be acceptable to translate it as to understand this as Jesus kept on saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Mm-hmm.
This is an active, ongoing statement. So it's a powerful picture to imagine that as they're nailing these gigantic spikes into his wrists and into his feet, that Jesus is repeating these words about his enemies. He's repeating these words about sinners that have placed him up there on the cross.
You know, Eric, it was not that long ago, I think we had this conversation. Someone was stating that that Christians have no obligation to forgive people who have not asked for their forgiveness or who haven't repented or this sort of thing, right? So if somebody sins against you, that you don't have to forgive them until they've acknowledged what they've done, this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And and this is one of the verses we were talking about, where with it being unable to square that with this, where it's just, where you're like, the fact that Jesus is asking his Father to forgive men who have not confessed, repented, anything like this. This is one of the reasons that a doctrine of sort of universal objective justification is so big, because the question is, does the Father answer the requests of the Son?
Yeah.
And I would say that he does. Do they receive the benefits of this forgiveness? Well, those are received by faith. So we don't know. But we will say this, that the forgiveness of God is lavished over all of his creation. It is lavished over all of humankind. And that nobody is not only able to be forgiven, but there is nobody who is unforgiven in that objective sense. Yeah. That here Jesus prays for these particular men, and he is interceding for a world that has rejected him.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They're just incredibly powerful words. And they cast lots to divide his garments, and the people stood by watching, but the rulers scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was also an inscription over him, "This is the King of the Jews."
Yeah, this is remarkable. These sort of words of, "Let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one," or "that he saved others, now let him save himself." Well, you could not be missing the point of what is going on anymore, right? That yeah. In his willingness to die, in his willingness to not save himself, he is in fact saving them. He is saving everyone.
The hardness of heart that's on display here is something to behold, right? I mean, here Jesus is actively crying out for the forgiveness of his enemies, and their response is to scoff. The response is to mock. That is really the sign of the heart of a hardened heart. The hardened heart scoffs at the forgiveness of sins.
Yeah, well, and you see they're saying, like, look, if he's the chosen one of God, he'll save himself, not realizing that the chosen one of God saves others.
That's right.
What Jesus is doing here is what the chosen one of God does. He is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, the Lamb that must be slain, the Lamb that has been slain from the foundation of the world. This is what it means to be the chosen one of God. And they're saying, if he's the chosen one of God, why is this happening? I mean, he said he was, and look at him. Well, this is what it means to be that.
Well, and also the fact that there is a sign above him that says, "This is the King of the Jews," is clearly an attempt by the Roman soldiers or whoever to sort of put their thumb in the eye of Jewish people. So this is clearly like this is as good a king as you can have, somebody who's hanging from a cross,
mm-hmm.
not realizing that they're actually fulfilling prophecy by doing so.
Yeah,
but this is why the Jewish leadership objects to the sign. Like, you're mocking us.
Yeah,
say this man claimed to be the King of the Jews, not that he is. And Pilate, of course, ends up saying, "What I've written, I've written," you know. And so there is, you can see still there's some resentment. It's not like the two parties have come together in joy and great happiness.
No.
They're not in fellowship. There's no bonhomie here.
No.
This is them. Still, there's antipathy here.
Yeah. And as this is happening, I think or as you read, that, you know, as a sign hangs above Jesus, says, "This is the King of the Jews," I think of Martin Luther's statement that I know no other God than the crucified one. This is the truth, that this is your God. This is what makes Christianity so different from all other religions. Obviously, there's the part of it that it's all grace-based. But it also involves worshiping a God who was humbled and killed.
Yeah. A God who, in the midst of it, cries out for the forgiveness of his persecutors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it there. We're sort of mid-thought. We're coming up on a great passage that there's no way that we can cram in.
We can't, I know.
We can't cram it in. So we're going to have to wait till next week. Guys, if you'd like to rate and review the podcast, we'd appreciate it. Go over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and drop us that 5-star review. Also, if you want to be a contributor to the podcast, help keep it going, go over to 1517.org. Hit that donate button and you can become a monthly contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Eric, I will see you next week.
Sounds good.